Ani, and welcome to Bombsida, an Aboriginal news magazine program that features news, current affairs, a focus on community and culture, spotlights on entertainment and great tunes, and every flavor from Aboriginal artists. I'm your host, Jennifer Ashwasage. The Canadian Human Rights Tribunal has finally heard government arguments on the underfunding of First Nations children's services. The federal government wants the case tossed out. The case began 3 years ago and was launched by the First Nations Child and Family Caring Society of Canada and the Assembly of First Nations. Haida Nation President Gujo tells Bombsida about the newly created conservation and heritage sites off the coast of BC, and that work has taken a long time and something the Haida are proud of. The conservation site encompasses an area of about 3,400 square kilometers near the Queen Charlotte Islands. And National Aboriginal Day is just around the corner, and across the country, Métis, Inuit, and First Nations people will be celebrating their culture with the rest of Canada. In Ontario, however, the Moon River Métis Council near Georgian Bay will be holding its first ever event in the form of a soiree, which includes Métis fiddling. And a music project in Calgary for Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal youth is hoping to help keep high-risk kids in school. It's called the Cold Lake Music Factory Pilot Project, put on by the Legacy Children's Foundation. And The Drum Call Softly is a story written by Métis author David Bouchard and Cree author Shelley Willier. It's a wonderful children's story narrated by David Bouchard in both Cree and English. And just before we get to these stories and great tunes, your National Aboriginal News. Here's your National Aboriginal News. National Aboriginal Day is just around the bend, and on June 21st, there will be a host of Aboriginal activities coast to coast. And in Ontario, the Moon River Métis Council has planned its first ever event to celebrate the day and the Year of the Métis. That's something very special for Larry Duvall, who is the president of the Moon River Métis Council. He says his Métis heritage was hidden from him for a very long time.
My mother was Métis, and my father didn't know. My mother knew but denied it. So it's only the last few years that I've, been able to say I'm Métis and been proud of it and that. And it's something, this is very common amongst the Métis people, that it was denied years ago and they refused to say they were Métis.
Duval will be celebrating his heritage on June 24th at the Moon River Métis Soiree in Gravenhurst. And the Métis Nation of Ontario has recently signed a relationship agreement with Great Lakes Power Transmission. Great Lakes Power Transmission is a subsidiary of Brookfield Asset Management. In a press release, MNO President Gary Lipinski said based on province-wide consultations with Métis communities on the duty to consult in 2007, the MNO's leadership was directed to establish positive working relationships with companies like Great Lakes Transmission in order to guide future engagement and consultation with regional Métis communities in the province. The agreement sets out the process for Great Lakes Power Transmission to make use of MNO's consultation framework in order to engage and consult Métis communities on existing and potential projects occurring within Métis traditional territories in the province. Great Lakes Power Transmission manages over 550 kilometers of transmission lines in Ontario and is seeking to be included in some of the transmission projects currently under consideration by Ontario Power Authority. The province of Saskatchewan is out with its new consultation policy framework. Through the new policy, the province is trying to communicate more effectively with First Nations and Métis communities on issues that may affect treaty and Aboriginal rights. The government released the new policy on June 16th. Bill Hutchinson, the First Nations and Métis Relations Minister, is proud of the consultation policy. He told media it was 2 years in the making with consultations with First Nations and Métis partners, as well as industry and municipal leaders, to get it right. Hutchinson says the policy introduces a whole lot more certainty to that consultation process than ever in the past. In Alberta, Aboriginal youth aged 11 to 20 will be participating in a new 3-year program called Safe Communities Pilot Project. It's supported by the province and is led by the Legacy Children's Foundation in Calgary. Youth from Grand Centre, Lac La Biche, and Bonnyville High Schools will be taking part in a range of activities, including music lessons with the support of a team of community volunteers, along with RCMP officers and youth mentors. In a press release, Education Minister Dave Hancock said partnerships are important important to the success of engaging and inspiring young people, and this unique project will help them to realize their true potential by giving them something to express their talents and abilities. The Alberta government is kicking in $50,000 for the project each year over 3 years. First Nations and other linguistic minorities are eligible to apply for crime prevention or justice funding. The Access to Justice Fund can be accessed by those minorities in rural and remote areas and can be used for law-related educational projects in relation to legal matters like prevention and legal representation. The Access to Justice Fund is available through the Law Foundation of Ontario. The deadline to get applications in is May 31st, 2011. The BC Mines Minister is calling a Harvard Law School report hogwash. The report, Bearing the Burden, the Effect of Mining on First Nations in British Columbia, authored by Bonnie Doherty, concluded that the mining regulations in BC are unfair to First Nations. Randy Hogg, BC's mining minister, has dismissed the report and told Globe and Mail that he thinks the report is hogwash and questions why Harvard doesn't look in its own backyard or concentrate elsewhere in the world where there are impacts on Indigenous people. Meanwhile, after the report was released, First Nations leaders in the province called on the government to make mining legislation and policy reforms a priority. They said it's time BC legislation matched Canadian laws or the United Nations Declaration of the Rights for Indigenous People. And Haas has said the province is not interested in changing its more than 100-year-old free entry system. The Haida Nation in BC has established its own conservation and heritage sites off the Queen Charlotte Islands. Haida Nation President Gujo says they want to rejuvenate the area, plus minimize impacts of global warming to the ecosystem in the 3,400 square kilometers of ocean. He says conservation and land preservation is very important.
I think all of us who fought for our rights over the years know that there's no use having rights if there's no fish around. No use having rights to hunt if there's no game around, and so we have to protect our lands if we expect to keep our lifestyle.
He says the areas will be managed for sustainability with some commercial activity allowed and others not. He hopes life will rebound there and says it may take decades, but he cautions the bigger picture also needs to be looked at when considering the issues of global warming. Native Women's Association of Canada has announced a new program to help women gain more skills. The national project, entitled Building the Scope, is to provide direct and immediate opportunities for leadership development and attainment for Aboriginal women and youth in literacy and essential skills through partnerships. There are two components to the program. There will be funding opportunities to upgrade literacy skills and or obtain high school diplomas. The second component includes formal accreditation, designations and certificates for Aboriginal-specific courses in governance, financial accountability, and community development. The Moose Cree First Nation and Ontario Power Generation have begun construction on the biggest hydro project Northern Ontario has seen in about 40 years. The $2.6 billion project will take about 5 years to complete. The Lower Mattagami project will add 438 megawatts to four of its existing hydro stations along the river, and that means once complete, there will be almost double the amount of power coming out of those stations. And in the partnership agreement, the Moose Cree have 25% ownership of the project and 25% of the revenue flowing from the increased output. And also in Ontario, the Flying Post First Nation wants to reclaim land to develop a reserve in the Timmins city limits. Chief Murray Ray says the current land they own is not suitable for development.
A lot of it is swamp, so we've never, since we got it in 1906, we didn't want to move there.
And that's why they're looking to reclaim a half square mile within the city's limits. He says the area near the highway means better access.
Then we're thinking of the idea of moving part of the reserve or that shortfall closer to the highway someplace so where we can access. It'd be a little easier to set up a reserve.
Ray says the plans are in the early stages, adding it will take at least 5 years to move forward. And that's your National Aboriginal News.
Squeezes, you ask me why. I don't know the answer of why women die. Squeezes, you ask me why the women who suffer and sigh for their cries. Should we ignore their pain and choose? grant us the strength to resist and survive. Sing out, ya-ha, hey-ya, wa-hey-yo. Oh, bring us the wisdom to staying alive. Hey-yo, 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 hey-yo. As we says, oh, how you've grown, found you a lover to call your own. As we says, I should have known.
Osini, a contemporary Aboriginal women's trio from Edmonton. Esquasis was a cut from their CD, Rattle and Drum. The Canadian Human Rights Tribunal will be deciding on whether or not to continue hearings into the federal government's underfunding of First Nations children's services. The case was launched 3 years ago by the First Nations Child and Family Caring Society and Assembly First Nations. The organization wanted the Human Rights Tribunal to determine whether the underfunding of First Nations children's services constitutes discrimination under the Canadian Human Rights Act. The tribunal heard from the government June 2nd and 3rd. Cindy Blackstock from the First Nations Child and Family Caring Society explains the details of what happened at that hearing.
Well, one of the first things is that your listeners need to know is that we had over 100 people there each day. The Canadian Human Rights Tribunal tells me that's more people that have shown up for a Canadian Human Rights hearing than ever before. What Canada did is it opened its argument saying, you know what, tribunal, even though the federal court has said twice there should be a full hearing on the facts, we don't think that's right and we should dismiss it. On a legal loophole, that funding is not a service, therefore it falls outside the jurisdiction of the complaint. After that, we of course disagree strongly with that, and the Amnesty International cited all the international law that says that there should be a full hearing on the facts. Same with the Chiefs of Ontario. And then the Assembly of First Nations went, and they talked about the long-term history where Canada has put itself between First Nations and their lands, and, of course, between First Nations parents and their children, and the devastating impacts that's had. And now they feel that Canada is trying to obfuscate its duties towards First Nations children and child welfare today on a legal loophole. The Assembly of First Nations was questioning whether or not the regime of assimilation has ended or not. They called strongly for a full hearing on the facts. The Caring Society Council followed. We went through INAC documents themselves that, A, show the funding is inequitable, see link that underfunding to growing numbers of children going into foster care unnecessarily, and C, knowing that they're going into foster care unnecessarily, sets children up for multiple harm. We also talked about the unbelievable level of control that the government has over First Nations children, and we pointed out to the tribunal chair that if she doesn't allow a full hearing on this fact, there's very little recourse for First Nations kids on human rights issues. Well, the government of Canada responded to all of us who are against them, and they said this. They said, you know, in some ways, we're the good guys. People could think of us as the good guys because at least we're providing some funding, even though it's grossly inequitable, to these First Nations kids. And then they went on to say, well, you know, you should dismiss this because the higher concern, more concerning than the kids' issues that the complainants are talking about, is whether or not this complaint falls within the jurisdiction of the Commission, or Canadian Human Rights Tribunal. That's what Canada told the chair was the most important point. And it said, well, the complainants would have other ways of being able to raise their concerns about children. And one of the ways they raised was political. And, of course, we had tried that for 10 years before we went to the tribunal. So that's what happened yesterday. The tribunal chair has not ruled. We're expecting her ruling in the next several weeks.
Okay, and I look forward to speaking with you again when that happens.
Well, we're very convinced that on the facts that we heard yesterday, Canada's argument was so weak that she should rule for a full motion on hearing. And we would hope that we would have a hearing on the merits and people would be able to hear all the evidence firsthand. If she rules against us, I think there's agreement that we would appeal that decision up to the federal court, and we will continue it as long as we need to get justice for the children.
And how important is this issue for the rest of First Nations children and Canadians?
This is a huge precedent-setting case, because what is the question here is whether or not First Nations people have access to the Canadian Human Rights Act when the federal government is underfunding any service on reserve. So this complaint could be about education, it could be about housing, it could be about all these other issues. And in some ways, that's why we think Canada is fighting it so hard. It's crazy, because, you know, equality is supposed to be a Canadian value, and the Indian Affairs Department, after all, is supposed to be looking after our interests. But it was very hard to see either one of those things yesterday in the courtroom with Canada's response.
Is there anything else you'd like to say or add?
The other thing I would like to say is how uplifted we have been with the number of Canadians signing on to the I Am a Witness campaign, which is at fnwitness.ca. People are just agreeing to watch this case and educate themselves about what's happening. There are now over 5,600 people registered as witnesses, making this the most watched formally watched court case in Canadian history. So no matter what Canada does, Canadians are going to hold them accountable for it, and I'm so very grateful for that.
That was Cindy Blackstock, Executive Director of the First Nations Child and Family Caring Society. The Haida Nation in BC has established its own conservation and heritage sites. The site includes 3,400 square kilometers of ocean near the Queen Charlotte Island. The work is something Haida Nation President Gujo says is very important, and he's been working on the project for the past 20 years.
While the federal government has put in an amendment to the National Marine Parks Act to include this one, and that's on their side of the equation. On our side, we've already designated that area to be protected. So this thing will be managed, recognizing two separate authorities, two separate jurisdictions, jointly managing protected marine area, probably in North America at least.
And like you said, the Haida were the first ones to consider that anyway. And can you tell me what the area is that you're protecting?
Well, if you went in there to see a group of about 200 islands on the very southern part of Haida Gwaii, and it would be seemingly teeming with life, and it is. There's a lot of seabirds and, you know, all kinds of fish, salmon and shellfish and whales, and all those things are in the area. And yet those people who live here, the Haida people, the older people, have seen it in a far richer state and seen the depletion over the years. And so it is to protect it, you know, largely from commercial fishing for was about the main immediate threat in the area.
Is there any offshore drilling that goes on anywhere near there?
No. In fact, there's vast reserves of oil underwater, and for the last 30 years, we've turned back proposals to get in there. Just recently, Mr. Prentice announced that it will not lift the moratorium that exists in light of what's happening in the Gulf of Mexico.
Right, which is such a tragedy.
We are still facing another proposal. It's called Enbridge Gateway Pipeline Proposal, which would take, about the dirtiest oil there is from the tar sands in Alberta down to the coast, and it would mean about 300 tankers passing to the north and south of the islands if it goes ahead. We've allied with all of the coastal First Nations and other coastal communities and environmental groups and people along the pipeline route to do what we can to stop that.
As far as the conservation area goes, how do you think it sets the stage for other First Nations across the country to develop conservation sites of their own as well as co-manage them?
Well, in protected areas on the land and in the sea, there's been a lot of resistance from the First Nations people because in the past they've always been displaced by these national parks and provincial parks, and the difference here is that we still maintain all of our rights and our title in the area, and the management of the area basically is to maintain and restore the life that's there. We expect to bring it back to the full potential. And I think all of us who fought for our rights over the years know that there's no use having rights to fish if there's no fish around. Use having rights to hunt if there's no game around. And so we have to protect our lands if we expect to keep our lifestyle.
When you're saying you expect to bring back the areas to its full potential as it was before, how would you go about doing that, like placing moratoriums on different things?
Well, we would, first of all, everything would be managed for sustainability. There will be some activities, commercial activities even allowed in the area. And some areas will be completely closed, except for our own people will continue to be continue to take food from there. But just simply by the closures, we expect that it'll like all of the life in the region will rebound.
Okay, and how long do you think that will take?
Oh, some of it will be decades, and we do have to think that way and expect that might be, but that's all right. You know, I think once the lands are safe, you know. But we do also realize that there is this bigger picture issues that we have to concern ourselves with, like the global warming and other global issues. You know, the sea has been fished down all over the world, and we're seeing jellyfish taking over. We're seeing other species coming in already, like the hobo squid and things that are used to warmer waters. So our hope and expectations is that we could affect those kind of matters that are a concern to the whole world just by having some place where we could stop and take a breath and look at it and appreciate it without thinking it needs to be plundered and exploited.
Mm-hmm. And do you think that your conservation attempts are well respected?
Yeah, we know that it is, and our people have been fighting for the land and fighting for the sea for a long time, and as time goes on, I think people realize the necessity of that. In fact, Mr. Prentice was here, and he commended the people, you know, our elders and the young people as well, who had gone out and gotten arrested some 30 years ago to protect those lands down there. And now it's appreciated by people all over the world.
That was Haida Nation President Gujo. That was Calvin Holrath with Old Reel of Eight. Calvin is a Métis fiddler and also very active in teaching the aspect of fiddle music and has been touted by the Saskatchewan Cultural Exchange Society as one of the driving forces behind the revitalization of fiddle music. Calvin teaches annually at the Canadian Grand Masters Fiddle Camp in Ottawa since it began in 1996. He also teaches at numerous workshops throughout Canada and the United States. And Métis fiddle music will be one of the focal points at the Moon River Métis Council celebration on June 24th, and it's the first time that Moon River Métis Council near Georgian Bay hosts an event in celebration of National Aboriginal Day. Larry Duvall is the president of the Moon River Métis Council in Ontario, and he says he's proud of his heritage, but that hasn't always been the case.
We have the four fiddlers who played at the games. We have a jigger coming from Ottawa who it will dance, but will also explain the dance and the meaning behind it and that, and talk a bit about the Métis people and what we do, because fiddling and jigging is what we're all about.
And how often does the Moon River Métis Council hold events like this?
This is our first one. Now, we do have a fish fry and right around here, and we have usually about over 200 people come for our fish fry and that. And that's just a general meeting and then a fish fry dinner and that.
Okay, and why is this year different?
This is the year of the Métis, and so we're celebrating National Aboriginal Day this way to get the word out of who the Métis people are, because if you ask three people what a Métis is, you'll find two of them don't have a clue, and yet we're one of the only three Aboriginal groups in Ontario.
Okay, and you tell me what it means to be Métis.
Oh, it means to be, that's my heritage. It's something that was, the Métis people were shoved and hid for years because they weren't accepted by the white or the Indian. And now it's something we know we can proclaim and we can be proud of. We're the original hunters and trappers. We Métis people work for the Hudson's Bay Company and North Territories Company for furs and that. So that's our heritage from.
Is this, since you were saying it was kind of in hiding before, is this something that you've always known and celebrated?
No. My mother was Métis, and my father didn't know. My mother knew but denied it. So it's only the last few years that I've, been able to say I'm Métis and been proud of it and that. And it's something, this is very common amongst the Métis people, that it was denied years ago and they refused to say they were Métis.
So in those last few years, what have you learned?
I'm learning more about culture all the time. I've learned that some of my who I am leads back to being a Métis, and that I've always been a person that wanted to work on my own, like the outdoor, things like that, and didn't understand why I just couldn't tie myself down to one job. I would change from job to job, not out of work all the time. I was always working. I had to work outdoors, and we were traveling people. Métis are traveling people. We never settled down in one sort of thing, so we followed where the hunt was.
So you always had those itchy feet.
I did, always. And my siblings are all the same, and now we understand why.
Well, that's good. That explains something about yourself.
It really does, yes.
And the Moon River Métis Council is near Parry Sound?
Yeah, McTeer, Parry Sound, that area.
Okay, and what's the connection in that area?
Well, the connection is that's where a lot of the Métis people are. Our captain of the hunt, Louise Goulding, lives right on Moon Island, and she's the one that researches. She knows how to research our heritage and our background, and she's done that and found out, you know, that's where we originated from, sort of thing, that and Drummond Island.
Okay, and now that, you know, so many companies and whenever anything happens in the area, that there needs to be Aboriginal consultation. And I understand that there's about 5 First Nations in your area. Is the Métis Moon River Council consulted as much as First Nations in the area?
No, not nearly as much as the First Nations. And again, I guess that's through no fault of the companies. It's just the word Aboriginal, when they see this sometimes, they figure, okay, then that's First Nation, that's the only one I have to consult. But Aboriginal takes in the 3 of us, the First Nations, Métis, and Inuit. But the word is getting out there, and we are getting more consultation all the time. It's a slow process.
That was Larry Duvall, president of the Moon River Métis Council in Ontario. The Cold Lake Music Pilot Project in Calgary is geared to Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal youth. It's designed to help at-risk youth experience success, improve self-esteem, build confidence, and develop teamwork. The program is hosted by the Legacy Children's Foundation in Calgary. Here's Daryl Wernham, who is the CEO.
We've just been successful with Community Innovation Fund with Alberta Justice, and it is to create a music fact program in the communities of Cold Lake and Lac La Biche and Bonnyville.
Okay, and I understand that the program is geared towards Aboriginal youth between the ages of 11 and 20.
The primary focus is Aboriginal youth, but not 100%. There will be non-Aboriginal youth as well, and the program is really geared towards any young people that are, you know, encountering difficulties, whether it's the family has financial issues that they're grappling with, or whether it's a young person who is at risk of dropping out of school, or at risk of becoming involved in criminal activity or even gang activity.
And whose idea was it to start up the program?
Started it here in Calgary 5 years ago. And really to assist those young people and families that just financially could not afford musical instruments or music lessons. So we started raising funds for those families and for those young people. And as I said, it's 5 years now in the making, and we're supporting over 70 young people in Calgary. The project that we're talking about today will assist 20 more youth. In northern Alberta, we're hoping to double that 20 to 40 over the next year.
Okay, and what will the benefits be for the youth?
The benefits are pretty incredible. We've done a lot of research in this area, and we have found this as well just through our own work. But we started looking at the benefits just in terms of brain development in relationship to music. And what we found through our research, and there's just lots of documentation related to this, is young people start to perform better in school. And through a lot of testing, they have found that these young people do better in math, they do better in literacy, they get focused and excited about their opportunity, and they get connected with really, really positive role models in the community. And what we have found is that a lot of these young people really don't have much, don't feel they have much opportunity in terms of the future. They get quite excited about the potential that music brings to them and the whole music industry. It opens up to them, and there are a number of jobs related to music, so it's very much more than the lessons. It's the opportunity that it brings, and a bright future for young people.
So in light of that, and trying to introduce the program to the youth at those 3 different high schools, is it hard to promote it and get them interested and excited in that?
The program up there is just starting. We're going to be working with a fellow who's been a vice principal for a number of years, and the indication already is that people are quite excited about getting involved with him. We have a program on Morley Reserve, just west of Calgary, and our program is full, and those young people attend regularly. When I say regularly, 100% of those kids go to their lessons every week, and 100% of those kids are remaining in school. And that is an outcome that we were really, really excited about, and it's consistent with what we found through our research in programs in the States. So if we keep kids in school, then we have an opportunity for these young people to be productive adults.
And how do they get involved?
They get referred to the schools themselves, police officers who are concerned about what's happening with young people will make referrals. We also get referrals from organizations like Boys and Girls Clubs, YWCA, and other service groups in the community. We have absolutely no difficulty attracting kids to the program.
So
we actually have a waiting list in all programs right now.
Wow. So with the program, is there criteria for them to keep their marks at a certain average or their attendance up?
Yeah, there's an expectation that they stay in school and that they perform well in school and that they're staying away from criminal activity in the community. And again, our experience has shown that this program is very successful in doing that. Program we looked at in Chicago has been around since the 80s, very similar to ours. They have supported over 40,000 young people, and 80 to 90% of those young people have remained in school and or gone on to secondary school, and they were drawn away from street activity. So just super successful. We found the thing in L.A., we found the same thing in New Orleans, and similar results in programs we've looked at in Europe.
That'll be exciting to see the end of the project. And what else do the youth do? Do they put on concerts or anything?
Yeah, it's only there. Every program we try to build in festivals and performance opportunities. Also, we've built in some funds to get kids into studios. One of the ultimate team experiences is to get into a band and to have kids go into the studio and again learn about the profession. It's not necessarily the music, but they learn about sound engineering and production. And Audrey is very, very excited about this as a career. This is just such a positive potential for young people, and we find that when they get hooked and connected to us, they want to take us as far as they can, so we're going to support that in any way we can.
So what kind of music?
Oh, all kinds of music. Guitars are the primary draw for young people, but we have lots of kids that are interested in percussion, brass, woodwinds, all the string instruments. So it's the whole gamut. And the instruments we get to kids are donated by the community. We then refurbish them and get them fixed up, and then we get them to kids.
That was Daryl Wernham, CEO of the Legacy Children's Foundation in Calgary. Now here's Inez with Stick Game Jam from her CD, Sing Soul Girl.
You gotta find, looking and I'll see that
the spirit of celebrating National Aboriginal Day, which is on June 21st, I thought I would share a story with you by extremely talented storytellers for you to enjoy. The Drum Call Softly is a story written by Métis author David Bouchard and Cree author Shelley Willier, and it's a wonderful book with very beautiful paintings by Cree Saulteaux Métis artist Jim Poitras. Now here's the Drum Calls Softly, narrated by David Bouchard.
Step into the outer circle. Listen to the beating drum. Take my hand and hold it tight. The thing you seek is soon to come. Everybody's smiling because our hearts all beat as one. Listen to the drum. It calls. The magic's here. It has begun. Dance the round dance yet? It's always been my favorite one. My musum and my kukum, let me dance it to the rising sun. We set our teepee by the creek, where musum wakes me every day, when first the sun caresses the earth and draws us all outside to pray. We start the day by giving thanks to Mother Earth for all she brings. Then kukum takes to working by the fire. I can hear her sing. She's making bannock. We all stop to eat together by the creek. When soon she bids us gather around, I hear the water start to speak. That creek, it speaks in circles. You must shut your eyes and try to hear. It's telling of how seasons turn and how they have from year to year. And now, it speaks of a baby's birth. And now, an elder's place to rest. And now, it speaks of olden days. And now, of Raven's sacred quest. Sacred quest. Sacred quest. I find I'm getting thirsty when the creek invites me down to drink. My body soothed, I feel content. My soul is cleansed, I'm free to think. I bid my kukum to come near and ask if she can hear it all. I whisper softly, can you hear the circles in my heart? Dance in circles round the drum. Seek the magic and it will come. Shut your eyes so you might hear that song is sung to draw you near. Dance real hard around that drum. Feel the magic. It's here. It has come. It's right here deep inside of you. I know you feel it, 'cause I do too. The early evening brings out friends who come with hugs and warm handshakes, with caring smiles and laughter too, and stories and songs, some old and some new. How high can eagle fly, they sing. How long can bear lay there asleep? The drum knows all, we hear it speak. It answers us with every beat. I'm weary, I can hardly walk. When I hear a voice that calls my name, I stumble as I turn to look. Come back, my friend. You're not the same. Whose voice is this, I ask myself? Is it the creek, or is it still the drum? I listen hard and I try to think. It's from my heart, it seems to come. Have you danced the round dance yet? Of course you have. You're in my dream. You've danced in circles next to me. You now know things aren't as they seem. Your heart and mine have beat as one. We've danced all day on that drum. You held my hand and you stayed with me. You now are family. You're a part of me.
I hope you enjoyed that story. It was The Drum Call Softly, written by David Bouchard and Shelley Willier, and narrated by David Bouchard. Now, if you have a chance, check out the book. It's published by Red Deer Press. The book is beautifully illustrated by Jim Poitra and also comes with a CD, which includes both Cree and English narrations, as well as drum music by the very talented and well-respected drum group the Northern Cree, and was published in 2008. You've been listening to Bombsida with Jennifer Ashwasagay. Bombsida is an Aboriginal news magazine program which includes current affairs, arts and entertainment, and a cross-genre of music from Aboriginal artists. Bombsida means walking together in the Anishinaabe language. Music for the program is courtesy of Burnt Project One. If you have comments or story ideas, visit my website at bombsida.com. That's B-A-M-O-S-E-D-A. And thanks for listening to Bombsida.